The mutineer's commander wore what looked like an ordinary, regular space service uniform, though Cecilia wasn't sure about the rank insignia. His name tag read, Admiral Minor Drige.
So, you're the one who killed Admiral Lepescu.
Actually, I didn't shoot him myself.
From the expression on the man's face, that didn't improve her situation.
Useless old woman. If it weren't for people like you, we would have our rightful place.
6 feet under and well tamped down.
But you'll learn. You'll learn what we're capable of.
Wasting time making pompous speeches?
Take him to the brig!
The commander waved his hand. The menacing Nems closed in. The brig was much as Cecilia had imagined military prisons. Cramped, bare, ugly, and uncomfortable. And secure. What she hadn't expected on a mutineer's ship was the number of prisoners crammed into the cells.
Why don't they just kill the loyalists? Or are their own personnel so troublesome?
The guards shoved her and Miranda into a 6-bunk cell with 8 other women, who stared at them with sullen suspicion. One was curled up, arms clasped around her knees. She had given them only a brief glance before putting her bruised face down again.
This is not what I had in mind when I suggested a trip for your health. Sorry.
Miranda looked around the cell, then at Cecilia, as if she couldn't believe what she'd heard.
I scarcely think...
I know it's not my fault, but I feel the need to apologize. There we were, supposedly safe from all alarms until we arrived, and then wham!
One of the women, whose pepper and salt hair was clipped close to her head, looked over at them.
What? Who are you? Where are we?
I'm Cecilia DeMarctos, and this is my friend, Miranda Meager. We were on our way to the Guerni Republic, and 2 hours into what should have been a safe jump, we were knocked loose and back into real space.
The woman leaned closer.
But where... Do you know where the ship is?
No. I got the course from a standard navigation package, and whatever knocked us out fouled up the drives and the navigation. When your captain picked us up, I thought we were being rescued.
No such luck.
No. And I feel it's entirely unjustified. We're private citizens.
Wait. Meager? Any relation to Brune Meager?
I'm her mother. Why?
And you're Cecilia DeMarcos. Aren't you that friend of Harris Serrano's, the one who shot Lepescu?
I didn't shoot Lepescu. Harris did. But I would have if I hadn't fainted.
But I thought you were old.
I am, but I rejuved a few years ago. Someone poisoned me, and it was the only way to full recovery.
I saw something about that. And it was after that you were with Commander Serrano at Xavier?
From the looks on their faces, they all knew about Harris Serrano.
Yes. I gather you're all loyalists.
Yeah.
Why didn't they just kill you?
Cecilia!
It is the operative question. She has to wonder if we're decoys or something, to sneak information out of you.
She grinned complicitly at Cecilia and stuck out her hand.
I'm Chief Jones, by the way, m'lady.
Call me Cecilia. Or, damn it, Ceci, if you're in a hurry.
Right, then. I'm not entirely sure why they haven't killed some of us, but some of us are serving as entertainment for their troops.
Jones nodded at the silent young woman huddled on the bunk, who hadn't yet looked up.
Besides the obvious, they seemed to get a lot of fun taunting us about how stupid we were not to join them at the beginning.
I see. They must be pleasant to live with.
You could say that.
Does this place have a...
Head, m'lady? Just over there. It's not, flushable. Sorry.
That attempted humor passed Miranda by, Cecilia saw by the momentary horror on her face as she saw the stinking bucket.
They like this part best, I think.
She made no move to use the bucket, but instead held out her hand to Chief Jones.
Well, a fascination with excretion does define a certain kind of mind. Let's forget the whole ladyship business. I'm Miranda to my friends. And you look more like a friend than anyone I've seen on this ship yet, except Ceci.
Right, Miranda. You might as well get to know all the crowd.
Chief Jones pointed them out as she gave their names.
We have Sergeant Taraki, Gwen's our engineering specialist.
Gwen Taraki had a small, earnest face and the calloused hands of someone who used them for something other than pushing buttons.
She can fix about anything, or build something that works better. Then there's Sergeant Dirac. We call her Dusty, because her mother named her something no one can say. Who's a scan specialist.
You worked with Kutsudis, didn't you, Lady... I mean, Cecilia. Amazing man. I'm a total idiot. He taught the ones who could learn.
Petty Light Donaldson. Jerry's also a scan specialist. Petty Major Sifa Pilar was in charge of the repair section for communications and scan. Petty Light Kuras. Jin's a drive technician. So is Petty Light Hartung.
Jones glanced at the huddled figure.
Pivot and Sally Markham. She's here to keep us quiet. If we do something they don't like, they torment her.
How bad is she?
Physically? One day in a regen tank would help, but she's not in danger without it. Mentally, she's close to the line, if not over it. She was a nice kid, but one of those who really depended on all the rules. Now they're gone, and she's...
Chief Jones made a wavy motion with her hand. Cecilia glanced at Miranda, whose face was white. She realized that Miranda saw Brunn in that huddled figure. Brunn, who had suffered alone, far away from anyone who cared. She glanced back at Cecilia, and Cecilia nodded.
Miranda can at least sit with her.
Chief Jones nodded. Miranda merely looked at the space next to Anseli, and Pilar Sifa stood up. Cecilia fought her stubborn mouth and managed not to grin. Miranda sat down and somehow, without seeming to move, made an inviting curve of her arm. Still without looking up, Anseli leaned into it, her shoulders beginning to shake. Miranda leaned over her.
Mothers. I don't know how they do it, but I'm glad she's here. You're sure you don't have any idea where we are?
Cecilia glanced around the cell. Jones nodded.
All I know is what the emergency locator system told me. We're supposed to be a couple of jump points away from Copper Mountain, the closest inhabited system.
It's the commander's bucket.
Excuse me?
It's an academy thing, Sarah. Officers tend to pick places off the usual routes where they can rendezvous with friends. They call it their bucket.
Sounds like a recipe for conspiracies to me.
It certainly can be. But in my experience, young officers just like to feel they have something private, some secret. The academy pushes them hard, turns them inside out. Probably most of them never use their bucket once they're well into their careers. Did your locator tell you whether the system has an ansible?
It does.
Sometime later, there was no way to tell how much, two grinning guards entered the cell.
I think you fancy ladies should have the shit detail this time. Let's see now. Red or blondie?
Oh, I think both. Both of them need to learn a few basic skills.
Cecilia looked at Miranda, but could not read her expression beyond mild distaste.
Pick up the bucket. Each of you one hand. You'll both carry it.
The bucket stank and was within a few centimeters of overflowing. The round handle on the bale wasn't big enough for both their hands, having been intended for one-hand carries, and it was hard to grasp, part on, part off. The thinner bale dug into Cecilia's fingers. The bucket was heavier than she'd expected. They lifted together, but Cecilia was taller, and the bucket tipped slightly. A few drops spilled.
Messy, messy. You'll have to clean that up when you get back.
It was remarkably difficult, Cecilia discovered, to carry an almost full bucket with someone of a different height, someone whose rhythm of movement you didn't know. Harder when it was necessary to sidle through the half-open cell door. A trail of smelly drops followed them out of the cell, down the corridor.
Keep going, girls.
The guards fell in behind them. Cecilia's back crawled. She hated having people behind her like this anyway, and these... She concentrated on the slithery movement of the liquid in the bucket, trying to compensate for Miranda's movement with her own, trying not to spill. Another guard stepped out in front of them suddenly.
That's far enough!
One of the guards bumped into Cecilia. She lurched forward, and a splash of liquid filth hit the deck.
You're a clumsy bitch. Now you have more to clean up, Red.
It's not my fault. You pushed me.
Wrong answer, Red. Blondie, take your hand off the bucket.
Miranda let go, but slowly enough that Cecilia could take the weight of the bucket without spilling any more.
Blondie, turn to face the bulkhead. On the wall, you stupid civvy. Snuggle right up to it.
When Miranda stood, faced the wall, the guards surrounded Cecilia. One after another gave her a sharp nudge. She managed to stand balanced, not spilling anymore.
You're going to clean it all up, Red, by yourself. And there'll be plenty to clean.
Instead of a nudge, this was a hard shove that sent her careening into one of the others who pushed her back. It took her hours to clean the floor to their satisfaction, with the single small rag they allowed. Meanwhile, Miranda struggled back and forth with the slop pails from the other cells, emptying them and scrubbing them clean. Her guards harassed her verbally, but didn't make her spill anymore. Yet, Cecilia knew more harassment would come. Just when she thought they were finished, the guards told them both to clean the guards' latrine. They gave Miranda a little rag like hers and pushed them both into the latrine. It had two urinals, two stalls, four sinks, and a shower. That took another hour or so because the guards swore they had missed a speck here in this corner, or on top of that mirror, or behind that pipe. At the end of that first day, Cecilia hurt from her toes to the top of her head and all the way past her fingertips. Her knees were sore and her back hurt. Her hands were red and raw. Her bruises were darkening. Miranda looked tired, too, her palms marked with the red lines of the bucket bales. But at least she hadn't had to crawl around on her knees all day.
But we're alive, and alive is better than dead. So far.
Supper was a meager bowl of some unflavored gruel, sipped without utensils from a plastic bowl which had to be handed back. Someone from another cell was brought out to wash the bowls afterward. Then the lights dimmed, and Chief Jones explained that they were allowed to sleep only during this shift, so 4 of the 10 had to sleep on the deck with barely room to stretch out.
We rotate bunk and floor assignments. Your number's 9 and 10, so I've redone the rotations. 6 nights out of 10, each person gets a bunk. 4 nights, the floor. What we did was put numbers in a pile and draw them out. What was left was yours. You're 4, Miranda, in the rotation, and Cecilia, you're 9. We're starting fresh, so that means Miranda has a bunk the next 4 days. Cecilia, you have the floor.
But she worked harder.
Chief Jones cocked an eye at Cecilia.
That's all right. I'm tired enough to sleep on anything.
Good.
Despite what she'd said, Cecilia found the floor hard and unforgiving, with a nasty, cold draft. No matter what position she lay in, something hurt, mostly a fresh bruise. She dozed off and on, but it was nothing like a real rest. Cecilia realized that she had finally achieved something like real sleep when she was rudely awakened by a guard with a bucket.
Rise and shine! Get off those racks, you shitbirds!
After some days of this, the guards abruptly handed them mops and sponges.
Use these. You've got more to clean than just this head. And the way you work, it'll take you a month with rags.
After they'd cleaned the guards' latrine, they were taken out of the brig area and down the corridor. Cecilia glanced through doorways they passed and saw stacked bunks in rows.
Crew housing? It must be.
The guards kicked open a door into a huge tiled room. Urinals on this wall, toilet stalls on that, rows of shower stalls, rows of sinks.
Start at that end. And don't miss anything.
And you'll need these.
The other unlocked a cabinet in which were toilet bowl brushes and jugs of chemicals labeled for their intended use. Cecilia headed for the far end and dipped a brush in a toilet bowl. Miranda, without saying a word, went to the urinals. Aside from choosing a urinal she'd already cleaned to use, the guards didn't harass them that day. Cecilia scrubbed, polished, mopped, and cleaned as if she'd been born a janitor. The guards lounged near the door, clearly bored. Within a few days, they were spending all day every day cleaning four latrines, the guards and three others on the crew deck. Cecilia was able to describe to Chief Jones in detail what equipment was being stored where, exactly what chemicals were in the equipment closets where they picked up and returned mops, brooms, sweep vacs, brushes, and sponges, exactly how many people were usually around in each corridor and head. Day by day, she brought in more information, a snippet at a time, and day by day, their guards became more and more bored. To amuse themselves, they occasionally dirtied an area the women had cleaned and demanded that it be cleaned again. And as they'd decided, the women feigned exhausted submission. That wasn't much fun. The guards began sneaking off singly. They never actually left the women alone and unwatched, but they weren't anywhere near as alert as before. Cecilia had time to think, and one sleep shift, she told Chief Jones what had occurred to her, the answer to a question that had puzzled her since her capture.
I know what they want you alive for.
Prisoner exchange, ransom.
No, they want you for prey.
Prey?
When I was on Cerealis, when Admiral Lupescu was killed, when Harris Sorado shot him, that's what he was doing. Hunting people as sport.
The chief's eyes narrowed and focused far behind Cecilia's face.
They want a hunt, do they? Fine. We'll give them a hunt. We start now, here.
Cecilia had been prepared for shock, for anger, but not for this almost glee.
But...
No. There is only one answer. It must not be their hunt, but ours.
Harris Serrano, having finally gotten her ship in order, or mostly in order, explained their mission.
We're looking for mutineers, by watching jump points and looking for out-of-range Ansible transmissions. We engage and destroy mutineers, change out the recognition codes on Ansibles and system defenses. If we find minefields, we'll clear them.
What if they leapfrog us?
They may, but if we work our way through the jump points in between, we should pick up their trail before that happens. That was the reason for rushing crews onto ships and getting them into space, to move into this area and interdict their movement. That still gives them a lot of space, but at least it protects our most vulnerable civilians.
Do you think they'd attack civilians, Captain?
I imagine they will, unless all they wanted was to run off and set up somewhere on their own. But so far no one's reported direct communication with them. All we have is that one report from Vigor, which had the sense to run like a rabbit with a distress message when it realized there was trouble. By the time we come out of jump, I expect to hear more. If they were agents of a foreign power...
The Black Scratch.
The Benignity, or any other. I suppose someone might even have fallen in love with the lifestyle of a New Tech's religious fanatic. My point is, it's too early to form conclusions about what these mutineers are like, except dangerous. We know they took over the Copper Mountain orbital station and freed prisoners from the high-security brig. It's our job to keep them penned up until someone figures out who they are and how to deal with them.
Captain, won't this concentration leave border defense in jeopardy?
As I understand it, units are being pulled only from friendly borders. Nobody seriously thinks the Lone Star Confederation or the Guerni Republic or the Emerald Worlds want to invade us. There may be more smuggling than usual, but we can stand that.
Seabolt lingered when the others left.
I'm worried about security.
In what way, Commander?
Well, as you know...
Harris repressed a sigh. Seabolt insisted on starting off by telling her what she knew, what anyone with a brain knew, before finally coming to his point. And nothing she'd done had cured him of it so far.
As you know, there's a mutiny.
I had gathered that. And your point is?
This crew is full of people with no shipboard experience. We don't know if they're qualified. We don't know if they're a part of the conspiracy. Since everything's going smoothly now, I want to start working on their dossiers. Did you know we have five people aboard who belong to the Church of Unified Brethren? And they have been holding meetings in a squat bay.
No.
It's true. And there was an advisory out only 6 months ago about all religious groups, that they might harbor extremists.
I mean, no, you may not start witch hunting. I did know about Corporal Senis and Solis, and Pivot's Mercator, Janowitz, and Bader. They're not extremists. and the Unified Brethren have never been any problem.
But, Captain...
Commander, everything is going as smoothly as it is, although not nearly as smoothly as it should, because I am working very hard to find and nurture those who have competence. Among those people with competence is, for instance, Petty Major Tanira, who is also one of the Unified Brethren. There are at least 50, not 5, aboard. Tanira is the reason we didn't have a Level 3 incident when some idiot clerk out of your former office didn't see why a valve had to be shut to 3.2 exactly. I will not have you upsetting him or any of the others on the basis of some crackpot report generated a long way from real ships or real combat.
But, Captain...
Is that clear, Commander?
Yes, but I must respectfully disagree.
You can disagree all you want, but you will not. Repeat, not. Go digging around making people feel that they're not trusted. We may have a would-be mutineer aboard. If we do, the best way to make that person try something is to create distrust and disaffection among everyone else. We may have a Benignity spy, or a serial killer, or a person whose idea of fun is being thrashed with dead snakes by someone wearing green paint. But in all those cases, until something definite happens, our best strategy is to build up this crew. And building up the crew starts with building their competence and their confidence in their commanders.
You're just like they said.
And how was that?
Serranos, all of you. You won't listen to anyone else. You always think you know best.
Commander, aboard a ship the captain does know best. By definition, check your regulations. It's in my job description. And if you act against my express orders, that is mutiny, Commander. You are walking a very thin edge.
Seabolt turned pale, and sweat glistened on his forehead.
I didn't mean... Of course, I just...
You are dismissed.
Yes, sir.
He left.
If only I had someone, anyone to put in his place.
But she didn't. She knew she wasn't at her best with his personality type. They annoyed her even when they were right. But she would have to find some way of dealing with him. Gunnar Tarakian had continued his occasional chats with Simon the Priest whenever he had time, and didn't want to let himself brood about Betharnia and the impossibility of asking her to marry him. They had gone from Simon's history, which seemed unbearably dull to Gunnar, a celibate life among books and scholars, to Gunnar's. Simon seemed to find the life of a merchant or captain as unattractive as Gunnar found Simon's, commenting that poor Gunnar had never had time to think a thought all the way through. Gunnar forbore to mention that thinking thoughts all the way through had led Simon to a death sentence, and turned the conversations back to religion and politics. Simon seemed convinced that the Familius Regnant's policy of religious tolerance would lead straight to anarchy and immorality. Gunnar felt his neck getting hot, as it often did around Simon.
That's a nasty thing to say. Do you think I'm immoral?
No, Captain. Not that I've seen. But I don't see how it can work in practice.
It's a matter of respect. We respect the other beliefs.
How can you respect something when you know it's wrong?
I don't know it's wrong. I may think it's wrong. And in fact, I may think a lot of the religions I've heard about don't make sense. But that doesn't mean I can't act in a civilized way about them. If you want to believe, oh, let's say you believe that a two-headed turtle created your planet, why should I argue with you? I think it's silly, but then most people believe some silly things. My cousin would tell you that my not wanting to marry again is silly.
But people's behavior depends on their beliefs. You can't trust someone's behavior if they think it's all right to do wrong things.
Look, a trader sees a lot. I know that some people use their beliefs, whatever they are, to make themselves better, kinder, more honest, more faithful, more responsible. Others use their beliefs as an excuse to lie, cheat, steal, and murder. All they have to do is tell themselves the other fellow isn't of their faith, and that makes it all right. Same beliefs, different people. And the good people can be found everywhere, believing all sorts of different things. And so can the bad. What I think is, religion makes a good person better, and a bad person worse.
Simon sat in silence, then finally shook his head.
I have to admit that even followers of the true faith have done terrible things in its name. But you're coming dangerously close to a famous old heresy, that of special election.
Never heard of it. Come on in.
Esme Suiza stood there, looking uncertain.
Yes, Sarah, do come in and join the argument. We're talking about religion.
I don't know much about religion.
That's fine, but you've met Simon, haven't you? He's a priest from the Benignity. Simon, Sarah Suiza is from Altiplano. He's just talking about special election. Sarah, have you ever heard of anything like that?
Some of the old believers, if you mean the idea that some are born naturally good and others naturally evil?
Exactly.
Some apples taste better than others. What's heretical about that?
Ah, now, did God make one apple sweet and another bitter?
I'm not God, Simon, so I don't know. What I am is a ship captain with, up to now, a clean record in the Familius Regnant and adjoining territories. Not anymore, thanks to you. If what you say is true...
It is.
Fine. Then you are just the sort of political refugee my seniors warned me about. But at least not criminal in this jurisdiction. You understand I will have to make a report. No doubt a long and tedious report. About you to both my seniors and whatever officialdom shows up at Castle Rock.
Of course. I hope it isn't too much trouble.
It is, but it has to be done. I don't suppose you know anyone in our government who can expedite this for us?
I'm sorry, but no.
Then perhaps you and Sarah Suiza can thrash out the theology while I get busy on the reports.
Gunnar stood up and winked at Esme, who was looking startled.
Only if you're willing, Sarah. But he might be interested in your world's beliefs.
Please, if your old believers are related to the Senations.
They left together. Gunnar wondered if there was any counterbalancing profit he could show to make up for what this was going to cost.
Find out anything more?
Yes. I still want to wring your neck. But he's certainly no common criminal. He's a religious nut.
He is. He seems quiet enough.
Don't get him started on good and evil and something called special election.
That sounds like politics.
No, he was about to drag me into whether God made apples differently sweet or they just came that way.
Oh, dear.
Yes, he's a heretic to the Benignity, a nut to me. And God knows what the Patriarch would think of him. But I'm not going to keep him around to find out. We dump him on the government at Castle Rock and steal quietly away.
Well, then... by the way, our hero of Xavier is making Bethia nervous.
Why? What's she doing?
Well, Bethia says she's having nightmares and won't talk about it.
Good grief, Basil. The woman's military. Of course she's not going to talk to an actress. And how does Bethia know she's having nightmares anyway?
Women have their ways. The thing is, I was wondering if we should notify anyone.
Who, for instance?
Oh, her family, maybe? If she needs help, they should know. And Bethia said she didn't have time to contact him back at Trinidad.
Well, I suppose when we get into Cenebra, we could offer to place a call for her. But I'm not going to do it behind her back. We don't have the right.
At Cenebra Station, Tarakian Fortune crossed paths with Tarakian Favor, with a solid 14 hours of cargo exchange under the eyes of the station customs officer. Favor had the route down the length of the Familius on that border. Gunnar picked up cargo for Castle Rock, and she picked up his for Mallory, Inkman, and Takaman Rhodes. Gunnar was glad enough to have his extra crew helping. They had removed their costumes from the fashion containers and returned the mannequins to neutral programming, so the designs could travel on to the backwoods towns awaiting them. They both unloaded their Zenebra cargo, a matter of an hour or so for that, and Gunnar, as the newer captain, invited Elias Tarakian, captain of the Favor, over for dinner. Elias, 20 years a captain, had the assurance of that experience. In another decade, he might retire to the Fathers.
Well, Gunnar, you're doing well, it looks like. You've a smart crew, the way they got that cargo shifted so fast.
I have a message for the Fathers that needs to go by some other route.
Ah, well, let's hear it.
Gunnar explained the whole long, complicated tale as he knew it.
You'd have done better to have a dull first run, Gunnar.
I know that.
But you'd done as well as you could, I think. What about this theatrical troupe? Do you think they'll use us again?
I don't know. Bethia, their manager and star, has talked about settling somewhere and giving up touring.
Ah. She's the redhead, isn't she?
Gunnar knew what was coming.
Yes.
Handsome woman. Not that old. You really need to find another wife, Gunnar. Someone to make you comfortable between trips.
I'm not looking for a wife.
You say that now, but when you're retired...
Elias, please, enough.
All right, I won't say any more. I'll take your message to the fathers, and I won't mention your... the redhead. You do know she likes you.
I know no such thing. She's polite to everyone.
None so blind.
Do you want to meet the heretic?
No. What do I know about theology? Now, if you'd extricated a specialist in olive genetics...
I'll tell Basil that, shall I? If you must take in fugitives, make sure they have saleable information.
Elias gave him an enigmatic look.
As a matter of fact, Gunnar, that's exactly what you should do. Policy is, we don't take fugitives or mix with politics. Practically speaking, if you must take in a fugitive, make sure it's someone whose passage profits us.
Huh. I don't think we'll make much of this theologian, but perhaps there's a hidden treasure in this theatrical troupe. I've got that lighting in the shuttle bay now.
Remembering the ease with which crews got drunk and spilled secrets, Gunnar didn't permit his illicit passengers to debark at Zenebra. He offered Esme a chance to send word home to Altiplano, but she declined at first.
But they should know.
They'll just worry.
Of course they'll worry. That's what they're supposed to do. You say they knew about the marriage?
That's what the captain of the ship we were on told us, yes.
And then you just disappeared. They could think you're dead, and they could help you.
I don't think so.
I'm not comfortable with this. I feel almost like a thief, as if I'd stolen you away.
Not likely, but if you insist, Captain, I'll call home and let them know I'm fine.
She was not fine. Gunnar could see that. She was kilos thinner than she had been when she came aboard, despite what he knew was a good galley. But he wasn't going to argue that. Let her family take care of her. He would have paid for the call, but Esme insisted on paying the toll herself. The estimated delivery time for a regular Ansible relay from Zenebra to Altiplano was surprisingly long.
We don't have a real-time connection. At least, not unless you set it up and pay in advance. Messages are batched through. And there are, what, 3 or 4 relays between?
So we'll be in Castle Rock, nearly, when your family gets your message.
Unless it makes the minimum transit, but... I don't see that it makes any difference. They're hardly going to come charging to the rescue. They have their own lives.
Gunnar said nothing more, but when she had gone, he placed his own call. If she were his daughter, he'd want to know what had happened by priority access. On the passage from Zenebra to Rockhouse Major, the main commercial docking point orbiting Castle Rock, Gunnar racked his brain to find some way to make a profit from his cargo. He talked to all of them, Simon, Betharnia, the other acting troupe members, Esme Suiza, seizing on every scrap of information that might be useful later. Talks with Simon always ended in a theological briar patch he saw no purpose in, but the actors had a unique viewpoint of all the places they'd been and ships they'd traveled on. The difficulty of finding sound engineers on a particular world, the timing of theater and music festivals. Gunnar filed it all away. Esme was sure she wouldn't get back into fleet, not for a long time, but Gunnar, thinking of her as a conduit to Brunn Meager and fleet both, plied her with Tarakian and Sons trade doctrine. What they wanted from fleet, what they wanted from the government, just in case she might be in a position to say something useful. All this almost kept his mind off fantasies of himself and Bethia. Esme pored over the meager news available. The very meagerness worried her. If the mutiny had been crushed in these past weeks, that surely would be in the news. Instead, she noticed talk of rising prices, of concern by traders, and reassurances from fleet. She had wanted so badly to find out about Baron, but civilians had no access to the fleet personnel databases.
Would they even tell me if something had happened?
I am his wife, after all. If Admiral Serrano hasn't forced an annulment.
The shuttle down to the surface lurched and swayed as it met a cold front and sank through it toward the landing field. Baron tried to put his mind on something else, but every time he closed his eyes, he saw that dark chamber, the glitter of headlamps on wet metal. Then Gormley's frightened voice and the brilliant flash. Every bounce of the shuttle reminded him of the abrupt shifts of the artificial gravity and that scything light. The shuttle's landing gear slammed into the ground. Baron looked at the others. No one was watching him. Each seemed sunk in a private reverie. He hoped theirs were better than his. Copper Mountain's reception hall looked just the same, ugly murals and all, as the first time he'd seen it. Worse, because now he wasn't a student, come for a course. Now he was a casualty, loaded into an ambulance with three others as if they were slabs of meat. Someone who still might not make it, who shouldn't be cluttering up the sickbay of a fighting ship. He'd overheard that reason for shipping some of them here for treatment downside. On the ride to the hospital, all he could see out the back was a lowering gray sky that exactly expressed his mood. But at least it wasn't a ship. The gravity wouldn't shift, or the ground split, or the air sweep off into vacuum. His first examination did nothing to dispel his gloom. When doctors muttered and prodded at parts of yourself you couldn't see, it never meant anything good. The phrase, "the best they could," occurred several times.
"I'm sorry, but we're going to have to combine surgery and regen technology. You'll be off duty quite a while. You'll need some rehab afterwards because of prolonged immobilization. But you should make a full recovery."
The surgeries and regen treatments took over a week. When they were done, the surgeons came in to brag about their work, and Baron realized for the first time just how narrowly he'd missed death. Both legs, both arms, pelvis, two crushed vertebrae, and a depressed skull fracture. And the burns.
"You're lucky to be alive. Your ship's surgeons did a good job with what they had. But you've been immobile for several months and your muscle mass is down."
Baron could see that now that he wasn't encased in splints and casts.
"So the next thing is to get you back in motion so you can start getting fit again."
Several weeks later, when Baron was able to walk the length of the rehab gym without stumbling or getting out of breath, he was put on light duty. He welcomed the distraction. He was getting stronger day by day, and his mind needed something to do. The assignment to form a support team for a forensic group investigating the Stack Islands marked his return to limited full duty. Baron looked at the information he'd been given and went to find Corporal Gellin Meharry. Gellin Meharry didn't look much like his big sister. Baron had met Methlin Meharry only that once on Harris's ship, back when he was trying to clear Esme's name. She had looked every bit as dangerous as her legend, and he'd wondered at the time why she hadn't had the scar on her face removed. It was not something to ask about. Gellin had the same green eyes, but his hair was darker, and he looked more subdued than sullen.
"Lieutenant, excuse me, sir, but are you related to Commander Harris Serrano?"
"That's right, she's my aunt. And you're Methlin Meharry's brother."
"Her baby brother, she'll tell anyone."
"I know the feeling, but from what I hear, you're no one's baby. You nearly scotched the mutiny before it started, is how the story goes."
"Thanks, sir, but that's not quite how it went. If I'd figured out a way to do something sooner..."
Baron knew that mental path well.
"If I had figured out sooner there were leaks in gas lines, I wouldn't have lost two men out of my damage control team."
Meharry looked at him.
"Hull breach. Cracks in adjoining compartments and environmental. We were trying to save the growth chambers. Spalled fragments had gone everywhere. We had leaks all over the place. I was so worried about the hydraulic lines, I didn't even think..."
"It wasn't your fault, sir. You can't think of everything."
"Nor can you. I'll bet you were thinking as hard as you could, weren't you?"
"Yes, sir, but I couldn't find a way."
"Sometimes there isn't one."
Baron didn't really believe that for himself, but telling himself that was getting him through the days.
"Anyway, Corporal, what I'm actually here for is that we're both assigned to a team that's going back out there. to both the prison and the weapons research facility, or what's left of it. Apparently, the powers that be think the planet is secure enough now that they can afford the time and manpower to do some forensic work.
I don't really want to go, Lieutenant.
No, I imagine not.
But we do what we have to. When do we leave?
Tomorrow. I was hoping you'd help me out. I'm supposed to pick some people out of the pool of extras, and I just got out of hospital. I haven't a clue who's good at what. The forensic team's already assigned. They're specialists. There's a bunch of civilian scientists and technicians. But I'm supposed to come up with data transcription clerks, communications, support, generally. You've been here for months. Could you help me with this?
Meharry took the thick stack of personnel sheets Baron handed him.
Of course, sir. How many? And are we supplying food service support?
There's about 5 on the forensic team, about 12 civilians, and I was told that I could have as much for support as I wanted. The Major said the more I could get out of his hair, the better. And yes, I'm supposed to arrange food service. And all I've had here is hospital food.
Baron was relieved to see Meharry smile at that last.
Let's see if... Yes, here's a good cook on your list. And another. Clerks? Coniston's always cheerful and doesn't make funny noises when he's working.
Meharry looked up.
Anderson's a good clerk, but he drives me nuts. He's always hissing or clicking his tongue or something. We don't need that in a small team. Coniston, Bunley, Mohash, and... let's see... is Simi... no. Well, Porto, then. 4 clerks ought to be enough. Communications... we should ask Ensign Pardalt, sir.
She's the one who built that whatchamacallit to get a signal out?
Yes, sir. She was a junior instructor in history, I think it was. And after that, they moved her into communications. She probably knows all the techs.
I'll find her. I'm guessing we need a couple of techs.
Sir, I'd recommend 4. If we have personnel on both Stack Islands, we'll want a primary and backup for each team.
Yes, of course. Do you think you can pick out the rest of what we need and have a list for me when I get back from seeing Ensign Pardalt?
Yes, sir. Sir, am I supposed to be on your team or with forensics?
They said they'd assigned you to me because then you'd be handy to answer any questions.
Yes, sir.
Baron found the communications building easily enough, but locating Ensign Pardalt took longer. She was not in her temporary office or anywhere in the main control rooms. Finally, a pivot said she was probably down in data analysis. Data analysis was in the basement. At first, he thought the young woman hunched over a stack of printouts was an enlisted tech. She didn't look up, which gave him a chance to notice the insignia before he blundered. He watched her a moment longer. Sleek red hair, hanging forward a little as she scanned the papers and tapped on her hand comp. Pale brows drawn together with intensity of concentration.
Excuse me, I'm looking for Ensign Pardalt.
She looked up and blinked at him a moment, then flushed and pushed back her seat to stand.
Sir, sorry, I'm Ensign Pardalt.
I'm Jig Serrano. Sorry to interrupt you, but I need some advice.
Advice? From me?
Yes, I'm supposed to assemble a support team for a trip out to the Stack Islands, and I need the names of some decent communications techs. Corporal Meharry suggested that you might know who on this list would work best in a situation like that.
Baron held out the list.
Oh, well, I don't know them all.
But she scanned down the list. He recognized total concentration.
How many?
4 or 5.
Pardalt rattled off 4 names, marking them with her stylus.
Thanks. May I ask what you're doing?
Trying to figure out who disabled the weather satellite so that no one saw the Bonar Tai's troop shuttles approaching the Stack Islands. The problem is, MetSat 4 has been acting up for a couple of years, so it could have been just a random glitch.
Convenient, though. The previous acting up could have been a cover for this.
Yes, but I can't think of a way to prove or disprove that.
It sounded tedious enough to him.
I don't suppose you'd like to come along on our little jaunt?
Not really, sir, but of course if you need me.
No, that's all right. I'm just glad I don't have your job.
Harris Serrano had a few days' peace while Seabolt thought of some other nonsense to obsess over. So far, they'd been lucky. No mutineer had attacked them, and they'd detected no sign that one had passed. She was working on another drill schedule when she got a call from the bridge. Jig Hargrove, the junior officer on communications this shift, had an earnest face that turned even the simplest question into something serious.
Captain, I just wondered, what if an Ansible transmits a pre-message alert, but then no message?
What do you mean?
You know how...
Harris winced. All the junior officers had picked up Seabolt's habit of starting every explanation with that phrase.
An Ansible sends out an ID and clear channel blip before sending a message.
Yes. And the following message will be delayed by the time it takes the Ansible to return a ready message to the originator, and the originator's message to arrive.
Yes. So we expect a lag, up to about 4 hours, between the initiation sequence and the message. But I've been waiting almost the whole shift for a message, and nothing's come through. And Commander Dennehy said to report anything out of the ordinary. I just don't know if this is.
How long exactly?
6 hours, 18 minutes. I guess it could be a ship that's farther than 3 light hours from the Ansible, but most people don't try to raise one until they're a lot closer than that.
What's the ID? Why do you think it's a ship?
Hargrove held out a description.
Well, this is the system. It's got no inhabited worlds and no permanent settlement, though there's a research station on that eccentric planetoid. I suppose it could be that.
I suppose. One mapped jump point, but only a yellow rating. Oh, because of the planetoid. What are its back jump stats?
Sorry, Captain. I don't know. Just its comm status.
Commander DeFreeze.
The senior navigation officer looked up.
I need a back jump analysis of these coordinates.
Harris flicked them to his screen.
Right away, Captain.
Harris turned back to Jig Hargrove.
Does that Ansible have reversible scan capability?
No, Captain. The note on it in the catalog says it's just a single-channel model for the use of the research station. It's not even very secure. Its access code is in all the updated files. Anyone could have tripped it. Though I suppose it could have been just damage.
Captain.
Yes?
Back jump analysis. Because this isn't considered that stable a jump point, the only mapped one jump location is CX-42 Henry.
That's one of the go-to points for Copper Mountain.
That's right, Captain. Copper Mountain is the nearest two-jump outlet. Estimated FTL time 11 days, and that's due to the short leg in from CX-42 Henry. There's a notation that successful jumps were made to the vicinity of RG-773 Alpha, but they weren't enough to qualify for a mapped route. Estimated FTL time on that one is 19 days. Some of the scientists considered it a more direct route to their home systems over in Sector 5.
I suppose it would be. Do you have any data on that system which would tell us how far that planetoid is now from the Ansible? How long a lag there might be between an initiating signal and the following message?
I'll work on it.
Harris felt a prickle of excitement down her spine.
What could trigger an Ansible besides a signal? And why would someone start to signal and then fail to carry it out? Because someone stopped them. They changed their minds. Someone stopped them. If a loyalist fleet vessel or a civilian ship found itself in trouble with mutineers, they might try to signal and be blown away before they could.
Yes, and a flying rock could have hit it.
We need to go look.
Harris was as sure of that as of 2+2.
We're on picket duty. The Admiral said we're to interdict mutineer travel. Watch the jump points.
I am watching a jump point. I'm watching a jump point around which suspicious activity has taken place.
I don't think you can call a malfunctioning Ansible suspicious activity.
Commander, do you have any idea how reliable those things are? How rarely they malfunction? And when they do, it's something like sending a string of gibberish, not turning themselves on for no reason.
But
I say it's suspicious and I'm the captain. And the Commodore. I'm going to inform HQ, of course. Only an idiot rushes off without leaving word behind. And the next question is whether to go in with all the force available or send in a scout.
A scout would be safer.
For us, right now, maybe. But just supposing there is a mutineer force in that system and someone tried to tell us and failed. All a scout could do is alert them that someone knows their location. Similarly, if I take in one ship and it's not enough to defeat them, that's worse than not going at all.
You wouldn't take all. Everything.
They didn't give me this many ships to just sit here being a target. I want a tight beam to the Ansible and a secure code for transmission to headquarters.
Cecilia swallowed against the rise of sour bile in her throat. It had seemed like a good plan. It was a good plan. It was the only plan. But she felt more tension than before the start of a big event. Worse than riding down to a huge fence on a headstrong horse. It was just the same. She could be hurt, she could die, but she'd rather die doing this than live without doing it. Talking firmly to her fluttering stomach, she went on mopping the guard's latrine. Miranda was behind her with the brushes, the bottles of spray cleaner. She felt for the bucket with her heel without looking. On the next forward stroke with the mop, she pushed too hard, stumbled forward, lurched back, and knocked the bucket over. She whirled around and grabbed for it.
No! No, I didn't mean to. I'm sorry.
The end of the mop almost hit Miranda, who fended it off by grabbing it one-handed. Cecilia scrabbled for the bucket and picked up the bottle of spray cleaner Miranda had dropped.
Oh, you idiot! I knew you were clumsy, but...
Miranda lunged. The end of the mop caught the guard in the solar plexus. Cecilia gave him a spray of ammonia-based cleaner in the face as he tried to gasp for his next breath. Then she smashed his trachea with the handle of the glass scraper. Behind her, Miranda was taking care of another guard. Cecilia grabbed her guard by the arm and dragged him toward the cells. They needed his fingerprint for the cell locks, while Miranda inserted the other guard's key card and used his fingerprint to hold the brig access open.
That was fast.
Cecilia pushed the body up to the bars.
Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Here, help me lift him. He must be wearing lead.
Arms reached through the bars to lift the dead weight up until she could insert his finger in the ID slot.
Donaldson, you and Kouros get the other cells open. Taraki and Derek, go help Miranda at the kiosk. See if you can set overrides. If not, we're going to have to take their fingers. Send Miranda back to help Markham.
Cecilia swallowed and tried not to look shocked. She understood the problem, but the very thought of cutting parts off the dead revolted her.
Cecilia, you brief the other cells on the chemicals stored in this section.
She almost said yes, sir. Already, other prisoners were emerging cautiously from the other cells around the corner. Men with straggly beards under their shaven heads, women whose hair was just growing out.
This is our mission. First, we get word out to fleet about this ship in this location. Second, we do our best to disable this ship by going EVA to damage or destroy its scan domes, its communication masts, and its FTL nodes. Third, we try to escape. We need an EVA party, a communications party, and a decoy distraction party who will run around making as much noise and trouble as possible while heading for plausible targets. I've had EVA experience, and so has Petty Major Sifa. Who else?
Hands raised.
Fine. I'll take all of you. We already have Taraki, Dirac, and Donaldson on the communications party. Any other senior contacts?
No one answered.
I want two or three good scrappers with them. Good. You and you.
Jones glanced around.
The rest of you divide into two groups, one with Petty Light Kouros and the other with Petty Light Hartung. They'll brief you on the run. We don't want to sit here jawing until they figure out something's wrong.
Some of the men were staring at Miranda and Cecilia.
What about the sieves?
We wouldn't be loose if it weren't for them. They've already chosen which party they'll be in. Cecilia here wants to see the stars from outside, and Miranda's going to keep an eye on Anseli with one of the distraction groups. Anything else? All right, people, let's move.
The brig area was at one end of the barracks area, with only one exit to the rest of troop deck. On their way out, the escapees emptied the shelves of the lockers available. Three bottles of spray cleaner, two mops, two brooms, and a squeegee. One stuck the canister of toilet bowl cleaner in his pocket. They had the guards' weapons, the canister of riot spray from the kiosk, and the guards' gas masks and filters, a total of four. They had the little repair kit from under the desk and the damage control locker contents. Hammers, pry bars with one end pointed and one flat, tubes of adhesive and dispensers that looked, to Cecilia, very much like something builders use to caulk windows. Chief Jones had explained how they'd use them, and they'd ransack every damage control locker they passed. Rope, wedges. Soon they looked, in Cecilia's opinion, like a combination of mountain climbers and repairmen. At this time of day, the four nearest squad bays were always empty. Cecilia and Miranda went out to scout, carrying mops, buckets, and cleaning supplies as usual, with two of the men pretending to guard them. They made it to the first lavatory, where they could see down another empty corridor and wave the rest forward. The men took a few minutes to depilate their faces, making them look more like the beardless mutineers. The women could do nothing about their hair.
But it's grown out a little, and from a distance, well, we might be taken for men. Some of us, anyway. And you, Cecilia, if we get you into a uniform,
uniforms they could find in the squad bay lockers, along with a variety of other useful objects. Personal knives, ration bars, more gas masks, and pea suits. Miranda, in uniform, looked as perfectly groomed as in her usual expensive silks. Cecilia looked rumpled. She glowered at her mirrored image.
How do you do it?
Do what?
Look like that. Do you have a spell you put on cloth so it won't wrinkle when it's on you?
No. I don't know how it works. It just does.
Once the groups separated, Cecilia quickly lost track of the turns, the ascents and descents, through unmarked passages. She struggled to keep the coil of rope she'd been given from falling off her shoulder, and the several tubes of adhesive tucked into her uniform poked her uncomfortably.
How do they know they're going the right way?
Yet Chief Jones hardly hesitated, moving with swift silence. They came out into a little room whose far side curved noticeably.
The hall?
Cecilia had volunteered for this, but now that she saw that curve, the reality of what she was about to do struck her cold. Chief Jones was already slapping squares of sticky patch to the overhead and bulkheads. It made no sense to Cecilia, but she didn't ask. Jones always had a reason, whatever it was. After another two patches, Jones grinned at her.
Blanking the sensors buys us some time.
One of the men had already carted the suit lockers. These EVA suits were heavy-duty models, intended for hours of use outside, with their size color-coded on the left shoulder. Jones quickly sorted them into a sequence of sizes and started them into their suits, tallest first. Cecilia was third. She stepped into the open lower legs, and someone behind her lifted the back of the suit until she could work her arms into it. Then it wrapped around to overlap the front section. Chief Jones checked the lower seals, helped seal the helmet, and then loaded the dual air tanks, which should supply 4 hours of air. She attached Cecilia's load of rope, tubes, dispenser to the suit exterior, and waved Cecilia to one corner, while the rest suited up, working in pairs. Then came the tedious business of working through the small airlock, one at a time. Cecilia had no idea how big a cruiser was, and seeing the outside didn't really help. Its surface, matte black, looked as if it had been cut out of the starry expanse, or as if it were a cave rather than an object that rounded out. Worse than that was the sudden loss of gravity. Outside the ship's hull, the artificial gravity had no force. She felt disoriented and was very glad of the safety line clipped to a ring on a sticky patch outside the hatch. As she'd been told to do, she followed the line from one clip to another, around a dull black plane that fell away from her in all directions. Suddenly, she saw something different. Something glittery. Chief Jones's directions had been clear. If it sticks up, break it off. If there's a hole with something in it, glue it up. Cecilia stared at a transparent flattened dome with what looked like an array of daisies under it. It wasn't exactly sticking up, but she couldn't see how squirting glue at it would damage it. Something tapped her arm and she jumped. Another figure pointing at the dome. It held a large hammer in one hand and very slowly leaned over to put a pair of sticky patches on the hull beside the dome. Then it stepped onto the sticky patches and swung the hammer. Cecilia had never really paid attention to gravitational effects before, and had certainly never wondered what happened when someone in zero-G performed a violent maneuver. As the person beside her swung down with the hammer, and the hammer cracked the dome, its feet tore away from the sticky patches, and it rotated overhead, feet describing a broad arc, and hammer swinging away from the dome towards Cecilia. She grabbed for it automatically, and the other person's momentum rotated around this new center, wrenching her shoulder. Then the person bounced off the hull and rotated back the other way. One foot caught on a sticky patch, and the inertia rotated his body around the long axis this time. Finally, the wild gyrations damped, and the figure tapped Cecilia's arm. She presumed it was a sort of thanks. Then, very carefully, the figure knelt and hacked at the cracked dome. This gave access to the delicate floral shapes of the sensor heads themselves. The pedal shapes came away easily. The other figure went on to another dome, leaving Cecilia to peel them out one by one. It was ridiculous. It was like the childhood game of plucking petals from a sunflower and counting out the answer to some childish questions.
They find us? They find us not. They kill us? They kill us not.
Not, according to the last of the petals she tossed away. She took her dispenser of adhesive and squirted globs of it over the ends of the stalks to which the flowers had been attached. According to Chief Jones, this would make repair very difficult indeed. Cecilia wondered, if this ship were ever found, what some repair doc would say about the damage they were doing. She, a taxpayer, was probably costing herself a lot of money. She decided that if she survived this, she would not prosecute herself. She looked around and noticed a metallic stick protruding through the hull covering a short distance away. She started to move toward it, and her tether caught her short. She almost unclipped before remembering the person she'd caught and saved. Instead of unclipping, she added a length to her tether, carefully, and made her way over to the stick. It seemed shorter, and as she watched, it crept down past her waist toward her knees. She gave it a whack with her glue tube and found herself hanging by her tether. That didn't work. She pulled herself in until she was clinging to the last attachment point. Then she thought to squirt more adhesive around the base of the rod. When it slowed, she formed a large glob on the tip. The stick didn't move. She hoped it couldn't. Cecilia had no part in the assault on the shuttle bay. Chief Jones had put her around the hull curve and told her to lie flat. She had the pleasant task of watching her oxygen level crawl down as time passed, while she wondered what was going on a meter below her and all through the ship. The others of the outside team, she knew, were surrounding the shuttle hatch, where they hoped the mutineers would come out to save the rest of the FTL nodes from gluey destruction. They seemed confident that they could disarm such a group and steal a shuttle of some kind, and Jones had promised to pick her up. It seemed a meager chance to Cecilia. As she had faced reality in those long months of apparent coma, she faced it now. She would probably be dead in a few hours, her long life over. She would like to have known if Ronnie and Rafa were doing all right, what Bruin was up to, if Miranda could possibly get that girl Anceli out safely. But life wasn't always cooperative, and she expected to die without knowing. At least they'd had a chance, and she'd bought them that. She reflected a moment on the irony of someone widely renowned as selfish, having humbled herself for all those weeks just to have a chance at breaking some others out of jail. She lay trying to rest easy and conserve her oxygen, as Chief Jones had recommended, and almost dozed off in the peaceful, dark silence, when a faint vibration in the cushiony hull covering roused her.
Is it over? Have they already extracted a shuttle? And is someone coming to retrieve me?
She opened her eyes to look without moving, and saw dark shapes against the starfield moving toward her.
Odd.
They were coming from the wrong direction. She lay very still, reviewing in her mind the exact sequence of movements that had brought her here.
Yes, that way is the shortest route to the shuttle bay. And this way leads around the circumference of the ship. But no one is supposed to be coming that way. All the other personnel hatches were glued shut, weren't they?
The cutouts enlarged, changed shape, and finally her eyes adjusted to the perspective, and she realized they were almost on her. They held weapons, real weapons. They had to be the mutineers, and they'd come up behind her friends. Without even thinking, she pumped the glue gun and took careful aim at one target, then another. First, the leader's rearmost foot, a half meter from her head, adhering to the hull so that he lurched forward off balance. She got another arm as it brushed past his side.
The Serrano Legacy, Against the Odds, is continued on the next CD.